The EMS Garage is a production of EMSRadio.com. You can find us on Facebook, just search EMS Garage. You can find us on Twitter at EMS Garage. Email us, emsgarage@gmail.com, or call us, 303-720-6001.
The EMS Garage.
Okay, I got DC on the phone. They want to know if you can handle that call as well. Just confirming you are checking the patient.
Yeah, I'm at 22 is on scene.
Welcome to the EMS Garage. I'm Chris Montero, your host, and we're live tonight on the internet, but we're also coming to you in your headset. I'm Chris Montero, the geeky medic, on all the websites, Twitter, Facebook, and wherever else you want to find me. I'm unfortunately not on any of the other like EMS social media sites anymore. I kind of dumped them because I'm really not on them very much anymore. So tonight we're going to talk about CPR and the new guidelines. It's now, instead of ABC, it's CAB. It's just a little hint. We're going to talk about paramedics driving into a lake, and then we'll talk about whatever else the audience wants us to talk about tonight. And we'll have a couple of cool contests. Now, sorry, I can't say contests. Our lawyer said we cannot say contest. So we're going to say giveaway. We're going to have a couple of giveaways for our next week's show. So you have to listen up, and if you reply by the following week when we tape this on Thursday, you have a chance to win. Because the person that is drawn will be at random of the people that reply. So there we go. So anyway, joining me tonight first is Mr. Jeremiah Bush. Hello, sir.
Hey, Chris. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How have you been?
I've been good. I just got back to California like 2 days ago.
Right on.
3 days ago, Monday night.
And did you guys do a last mutual aid show?
There are a couple new videos up. There's one from Expo.
Okay.
There's a swamp tour. There's also kind of a goodbye video from me at the airport, which hasn't been edited yet. But like, there's a few more up there.
Like, so. Sha-na-na-na, na-na-na-na, hey, goodbye. All right, well, very cool. I can't wait to see those. I've been following you guys, and it seems like a lot of fun. So welcome back to California. I'm not in California, but welcome back anyway.
Colorado's West Coast.
It's kind of West Coast, because I say dude a lot. Everybody goes, you say dude a lot. Whatever. It's just kind of the vernacular. Also joining me, Dr.
Text, dude. We talk about.
Yeah, well, I do text too. Dr. Bill Toon, hello, sir. How are you? And he's also joining us on video.
Hi there. How are you tonight?
I'm doing well. How have you been?
I know you look like you did a little work on your studio there. There's a nice backdrop. It looks pretty fancy.
Yeah. It's the best thing that a $1.99 at Walmart can buy you. So there you go.
So, now, did you take your company car there to go to Walmart, or
no, never. See, it's all fake. There's a lot of mystery right behind this curtain here. So, yeah, it's a lot of fun. So, Bill, thanks for coming on tonight. We're going to be talking about something near and dear to your heart. I know CPR is a lot of fun for you, so thanks for coming on.
Absolutely.
Also joining us tonight is Dr. Jeff Myers. Hello, sir.
Good evening. Good evening. How are you?
Good. I'm glad you could. I'm glad we could actually hear you now, which is good.
Little technical difficulties, but not insurmountable.
Completely understandable. And we're just glad to. It's been a while since you've been on, so we're glad to have you.
Yeah, I was doing a little bit of traveling, and then work schedule and that type of thing. So I'm glad to be back.
Right on. Well, thank you very much. Also joining us tonight, Miss Carissa O'Brien. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
And I'm good. I heard you had something come out in the Boston Globe today.
Yeah, I did. I was on page one of the Globe in a story about social media and location-based services.
That's awesome. It's too bad nobody reads print anymore.
Oh, it was online. Okay, just making sure. No, you know, the old people read it and go, I don't understand this Twitter thing. What's that? And just turn to page two. I want to see the sports. Who won, Phillies or the Giants? I don't get it. Anyway, I'm just teasing.
Yeah, nobody in Boston.
Yeah, I know. You're like, baseball season's over. We'll wait till next year. Well, thanks for joining us tonight.
Go Pats.
Right on. Also joining us from 3 p.m. tomorrow, he's in the future. He's future man. Ben Hoffman. How are you, sir?
Not doing too bad, mate. Two thoughts on that. I'm kind of having flashes of Back to the Future there. Very 80s. And my second thought is whether or not the Boston Globe equates to Boston's version of the New York Post, which nobody reads. But I'm good, mate. I'm good. I'm back on a lot of nights. I like nights. I don't have to hop up at 4 in the morning and go and work. And all the strange people are on nights, which is really good because I seem to fit in well with them. But, yeah.
And everybody says they can't hear me. Is that right? Well, Epi Junkie says she can't hear me. You guys can hear me on Skype, right? You're the only ones I care about. Okay. All right.
Chris, I thought we were going to have subtitles for our foreigner.
Just Ben. We'll have to figure those out. He says I'm very low. Everybody says I'm low. So I'm just gonna tweak my level just a hair. Can you guys hear me better now? We'll try that. And Carissa sounds muffled, but that's because she's on her laptop and whatever. It's Carissa. Also joining us tonight, Mr. Scott Keir. Hello, sir.
How are you, Chris?
I'm doing well. Doing very well. Just glad to be around. Glad to be alive.
Oh, me too. Sitting here following the game while we talk.
Oh, I see. So you're not really paying attention.
Oh, no. It's just that some of us in Massachusetts still do care about baseball. That's all.
Ah, gotcha. Very cool. Well, thanks for joining us. And finally, last but certainly not least, Mr. Kyle David Bates, all the way from Tonawanda. How are you, sir?
Tonawanda. Good. How are you doing today, Chris?
Good. You know, I've been talking to you far too often recently, so glad to see you. And well, it's been good. No, it's good things. I mean, tell me about your new podcast.
We just started it with Dr. Lou Romig out of Miami. If you're not familiar with Dr. Lou Romig, she's actually the author of Jumpstart Triage. And she and I have kind of undertaken a project called PDU, PEDI-U.com, which is a new podcast we just launched. It just got put on the iTunes, and it's going to be a whole website dedicated to the care and assessment of the pediatric patient in the out-of-hospital environment. And we have our first episode is up at PEDI-U.com. It's up for you to listen to. It's kind of a potpourri. We'll be recording our next episode next week, which will be, it's wheezing season, dealing with respiratory emergencies.
Like that?
Exactly.
Right on. Very cool. Well, I am so glad to have you on and so glad to have PDU as a part of the EMS Radio Network. And if you're interested in listening, you can go to PDU.com. Or is it PD-U.com? I don't remember.
PD-U.com.
Or you can just go to EMSradio.com and the link will be up there within the next week. And you'll listen to his show along with everybody else, Jamie Davis. And I should mention Jamie Davis. He's the editor that you don't see behind the curtain. But he's actually doing all of our video searching and really appreciate all of his hard work. And he's recording this podcast for posterity because we're actually trying to do this via video and audio this week. We're going to start two streams so you'll be able to look at us on video and audio coming up very soon. Oh, there he is. There's Jamie. Hey, Jamie. I'm glad to see you. All right, so the very first thing, obviously a big news story of the week is CPR and the new guidelines. And I just wanted to throw it out there. Who's seen it? What do you guys think? What's your initial reaction? I will tell you my very first reaction to the whole story was, okay, so we pump hard and blow less. Okay, we already knew that. Big deal. So we'll pump first. But were there any big surprises in that announcement to anybody, or just seemed kind of the same? Wow, everybody's
jumping in. I think it does seem a little bit the same. Some of the information I was reading, you know, no big surprises. I was actually, the one surprise I was amazed they didn't get into was more the cardiocerebral resuscitation with eliminating any ventilations for the first 6 minutes. I was kind of surprised they didn't get into that. We still are providing ventilations in there, creating the increased intrathoracic pressure. So that was kind of, you know, my read into it, and that's one thing I was kind of surprised they didn't hop on board with right away. I know it's kind of it would be a drastic change, but it seems like some of the information is pretty good on that.
Yeah, I agree with Kyle. That was, for me, a little bit of disappointment. I mean, they did. I was happy that they did sort of go that way, but still not. I still think that that airway needs to be pushed back quite a bit more.
Wait. Tell me quite a bit more. What do you mean, like the advanced airway, or just airway in general? Like we should do like a minute of CPR before we start, or I mean, what were you thinking there?
Some of the articles, some of the literature was actually looking at one, and I can't remember the specific reference, but looking at not providing any ventilatory support until the patient stops gasping. Which can be several minutes, especially if you're able to support the respirations. Or I'm sorry, support the circulation. So whether that's 1 minute, 2 minutes, 6 minutes, 10 minutes, at least what the literature seems to be indicating is that we really have enough oxygen reserves in our lungs usually when we go into sudden cardiac arrest. Again, sudden cardiac arrest, not necessarily that person in heart failure who's become hypoxic from a respiratory issue before, but your sudden cardiac arrest, we've got enough oxygen in the lungs that we can go for quite a while without really having to ventilate and bring about some of the complications of ventilation.
Carissa, I know we had that chat on Twitter today. What were your thoughts?
Well, I think it seems to me like the early communication around the guidelines are really focused, not entirely, but largely on the lay community, which I guess, you know, to some extent makes sense, but they're really focusing in on, you know, the guidelines changes, trying to bring about, an increase in lay responders. Being comfortable and confident in, basically taking out the breaths requirement and focusing on compression. So, you know, certainly got that feeling on the Twitter chat today, even though I'd say there were a fair amount of folks on that chat that were trainers affiliated with AHA in some way across the country. But there were a lot of folks joining that were lay folks that were just trying to understand CPR a little bit better. And so they're really focused in on, you know, on increasing that awareness and comfort level. So I think that may be why we saw, you know, a little bit less of a focus, at least initially, on the CCR piece. And my takeaway is, you know, just from my work with the Sudden Cardiac Arrest Foundation, trying to, again, reach that similar population with the right messages to hopefully start to make a difference in the survival rates that we see across the country. But I also thought it was interesting, kind of the initial assessment piece. And I don't know if you guys, what you guys thought about that, but it just seemed like they were stripping it down to the most simple, and I wondered if it was maybe taking away too many elements. And I know they're trying to take the fear piece out, but it just seemed like maybe they were making it a little too dumbed down. Anyone else think that?
Yeah, I kind of agree. It seemed way too dumbed down. Go ahead, Bill.
I'll take a different stance on that. I think what they did is I think Carissa hit the nail on the head. I think one of the goals is we need to see greater involvement of the general public involved in cardiac arrest. And it was interesting. One of the pieces that I looked at, there was an article put out from the rock group that talked about where they were looking at the CPR compression fraction or factor, and they were looking at the amount of CPR that was delivered within a minute at, amongst the different rock sites and its outcome on positive outcome on VFib cardiac arrest. But the interesting thing is when you look through the data, when it looks at witnessed cardiac arrest and it looks at citizen CPR, almost all the rock sites were reporting almost 50% citizen CPR, and I think that that is just phenomenal. In our system, we're struggling just to even break 20% of citizen CPR. So I think it's an important step to be emphasizing on getting the public in general involved. And then the other piece of that is another study that came out of Seattle, and it came out of their dispatcher study, where they actually went and looked at patients that who were not in cardiac arrest but had received dispatcher-instructed CPR. And the take-home message there people who are not in cardiac arrest are not harmed by the chest compressions. There probably would be more harm if there wasn't chest compressions started. So again, I think that emphasis to really simplify the process for the general public, take away the potential factor that could be associated with doing mouth to mouth, and just say, hey, get up, shake them. If they don't respond, start pounding on their chest. And if they wake up, that's great. If they don't wake up, that's better than not doing CPR at all. So I think they're heading in the right direction there. I don't know if you've had a chance to read it. The other one that was more interesting is the thing about even healthcare providers not being good enough to be able to detect carotid pulses. And that's also in there, is they even talk for healthcare providers that we spend too much time trying to find a pulse when it's probably not there, and we don't have the precision that we think we do to find it. So there's a lot, and I haven't had a chance to read line through everything, but there's some really interesting stuff in there.
Yeah, you know, Tim, what I found really cool. Oh, sorry, Krista.
No, go ahead, Jeff.
Oh, what I find interesting and also sort of motivating is that what the new protocol does is it addresses both sides, the lay responder side as well as the healthcare responder side, because for me, and I'm affiliated with a training center, we've been teaching hands-only CPR ever since I've been there. We go through the normal protocol and then we say, okay, guys, but when you get out there, this is what we want you to do, and this is why we want you to do it, for the reasons that you just mentioned about feeling safe as far as giving respirations and everything like that. But even for responders who know the protocol and have been doing it for years, I've found myself, and I see this is how my coworkers do, we sort of instinctively change the protocol to CAB because we get on scene, it's like, you go set up the airway, I'm going to start compressions. Mm-hmm. We don't wait for the pocket of the bag to get unzipped. We'll make up the BVM. Let me set this up. Wait, let me find the right OP. We instinctively already start with compressions. And for a new EMT coming into the field who's very focused on doing step A, step B, step C, it jumpstarts to that point of, well, now I've been on the field for 6 months or a year and I don't have to think about the protocol. I know exactly. I'm just going to do compressions. And it's something we've already been doing anyway. And now the new guidelines are sort of adopting that and addressing that, which is something I like to see.
Carissa, go ahead.
Yeah, so I agree with both of you gentlemen. I think I'm glad that you mentioned that that lack of harm data on the compressions, because that basically takes away my last little piece of concern on how they revise the initial assessment piece. So that's good to hear, because I am all for making it as simple as possible to get an increase in bystander action. We haven't seen these numbers change in decades now, and this could have a major impact on those survival rates. So that makes me a whole heck of a lot more comfortable right away. And I also have to say that rock data, while, you know, probably simply by the locations that the rock studies tend to be in, I mean, that 50% number isn't anywhere close to the national average, and I know you know that, for bystander CPR. So again, hopefully these changes are gonna start to see those numbers increase, and I'm all for it.
Kyle, did you want to take a question from the audience?
I am working on that
maybe,
right now.
Maybe you're trying to. Now, do I have to approve? Exactly. Oh, there you go. There you go.
Yeah, I already approved the one on
okay,
there.
Good.
I'm working on the other one right now. It's more of a statement for that. But, you know, I really don't think so. I think, you know, it says, you know, from the audience question says, I think that the CAB will be more for general public to know the change because we already do it, I think. And I agree. I think in EMS, we've been doing CAB. When I talk about my documentation lecture, I talk about standard of care, and I always use the ABC, ABC for that as, you know, as basically the standard of care. And I said, well, what happens if you do CAB? Because how many of us come in there as paramedics and providers, and we check right for, you know, I know what they're saying about, you know, not checking for pulses, but we would go right for a pulse, and we don't find a pulse. We're automatically starting compressions because odds are if they don't have a pulse, they probably aren't breathing on that aspect. So I really think, in a way, we've been doing CAB for years on that.
Hmm. You know, one of the other things that I thought was pretty interesting is they talked about not doing cricoid pressure when doing respirations. Well, they said, you know, it's probably not suggested to do that. The other thing was when you see somebody go down or when you find somebody down, you should instantly check for abdominal breathing while you're doing the pulse check. There's no longer a look, listen, and feel. And okay, I mean, I don't know that that those respirations really took that much longer. I think for the general public, though, it just kind of was kind of the ew factor. I actually have to do that. Versus now, I know even on a local radio station here, they talk about hands can save lives, and then they go into two hands, you know, find the middle of the chest, push hard, push fast until help arrives, and that's all you need. Who needs CPR training anymore? That's it. That's all we need to do. And if people would do that before we got there, along with a good community PAD program, we'd be set. And I think we'd be a lot further along. And I think this is a step in the right direction for the lay public. Again, I don't think in EMS it wasn't ground shaking to me. Losing atropine was good. It's about time, but it really didn't ever do anything.
But do we really look, listen, and feel? That's my question. Do we really do look, listen, and feel? Do we really sit there and do the, Jamie, put me on, you know, do the whole, you know, flip, you know, head tilt, chin lift. Are we doing that? You know, look, listen, and feel. I'm sorry, I'm not getting that close to somebody. You know, I always look at, in terms of EMS, we have other tools to use to do the look, listen, and feel. I mean, do we really do that in EMS?
Yeah, but do we need the listen if we've already talked about, we have difficulty as healthcare providers, one, finding a pulse. Two, we know that that the pulse stops, but there are still people that have those gasping agonal respirations. Yeah, again, is that listening part and having that in there, is that going to delay compressions? Mm. So I kind of disagree a little bit. I'm not sure that there's any usefulness to listening, and I know that it's a little bit controversial, but. Hey,
I agree. I mean, but I mean, if you look at it, you know, how many cardiac arrests have you actually had that they were breathing, and no one wanted to do CPR on them? Of course, you know, the breaths they're trying to do is, and Jeff, and someone help me with the science behind this because I'm just not thinking tonight. I think my beverage has been
coming
out.
Your vodka's gone to your head.
My vodka's gone to my head. But you know, looking at it from the standpoint of, it's actually the body basically trying to bring blood back to the heart. Is that what it's doing, Jeff?
I think that's what it's trying to do in terms of dropping the inner thoracic pressure. When we take an inspiration, our inner thoracic pressure drops. So not only are we bringing air in, but we're also increasing blood return to the right side of the heart. I've got to wonder if that's a natural mechanism that. It is trying to keep some circulation going with the hopes that the circulation will start up. Obviously, it doesn't do that a lot. You know, to kind of counter a little bit in terms of how many, you know, your question about, Kyle, about how many patients do we see in cardiac arrest that are still breathing. I think we've been banged over the head for quite a while in that, geez, if you've got somebody who's breathing, they must have a pulse, they must have circulation. And now this whole concept of, no, wait a minute, we may not have circulation with breathing is a change on that. So I just don't think we saw enough of that to really be able to say, you know, yes or no, I've seen it before.
I've seen providers not do chest compressions when there's been agonal breathing, and one of the most famous quotes I heard was, "Oh, they're breathing, so there must be a pulse." And it was very disconcerting since it was only a 34-year-old patient that was in cardiac arrest.
You know, I think this leads us right next to our next audience question from Hybrid Medic. Don't most priority med dispatch systems give compressions only instructions? Because I'm not real familiar.
I think the latest change went to compression only. I think the latest change did go to compression only, but I'm not as familiar with the EMD protocols.
I haven't seen the Claussen system in a while, but I know when we were reviewing it, gosh, it was almost about a year ago, it still had the whole cycle of what you should do in CPR. So my hope is they would go to that, and I don't. Generally, Claussen's pretty quick at making the changes. It's one of the questions I had today is how fast will EMS actually adopt this? I know the last AHA guidelines took 2 years because that's how long it takes people to get recertified. I just recertified in August, and now there's no requirement for me to go back as a provider in either through my paramedic or through AHA through my service to go back and get recertified on a brand new guideline. So,
as healthcare professionals?
Well,
do we have to wait that long?
Well, probably not.
Yeah, as a medical director, I've got the ability to change protocol. Well, all right, I'm in New York. Relatively quickly, sort of, kind of.
Next year,
I know someone's gonna. I know somebody. Somebody's gonna hear that, and I'll get a phone call tomorrow. But that's okay. We can change that relatively quickly. You know, we've already been talking it up. I've already been talking it up in some venues. I don't think we've got to wait 2 years for this to change. I know a couple of the abstracts presented at an AMSP last year talked about how long did it take in some of the ROC systems to really fully implement the 2005 changes. And yeah, it was a year to two. And those are in theoretically high-performance systems. I think we can push this a lot faster.
But I completely agree as a system, but I'm saying that by and large, I mean, let's think about how many EMS providers there are in the United States. About 500,000, maybe 700,000 last count. That's going to take a while to get through, and then it'll take a while for the Europeans to take it on. I mean, I just think we're looking 2 years out before it really takes hold. I know it was probably the last ones came out in 2005, so it took a fair amount of time to get the last ones out. That's all I'm saying. I think that it's just going to take some time for EMS to get there. But while I have the mic and while I have a chance before we go on to the next point and the next question, I'd like to remind you all to come on. So we have a giveaway next week. If you call our number, 303-720-6001, and give us an idea, you'll be entered into the competition to get two free Audible books. I have the code right here. I have a stack of them that we're going to be giving away. Audible.com. They've been very generous to us. And this is two free books. You don't have to enter a credit card number. You just have to sign up. And I actually did it this week. They gave me my two free books, and I'm listening to the Dark Tower series. I can't think of it, from Stephen King. And great, great audio. So audible.com, thank you so much for these two free books. So call us and leave your email address and your phone number in case I can't hear one or the both. Give us your idea for next week's show, what we should be talking about, and you'll be entered to win. So go to 303 720-6001. Leave us a message. Tell us your name. Tell us your email. And tell us your phone number. I promise I won't leave those on the when we air it on the show. And you'll be entered to win two free audiobooks. I guarantee there's nothing attached to this. It's absolutely free. So thank you, audible.com, and we really appreciate your time and your abilities to let us in. So now we haven't heard from Jeremiah and Scott and Ben. Ben, what do you guys do in New Zealand? I mean, what is your thought process as far as what you guys are doing in CPR?
Well, we do things backwards down here, mate. So we give that funny stuff called adrenaline, and
isn't that happy?
Ah, mate, subtitles. We have our clinical procedures, which get reviewed every 2 years. Last update was September of last year, but we've basically been doing what the new guidelines say for at least the last 3 or 4 years. In 2007, we said, right, if someone's in cardiac arrest, it's straight off the bat 200 compressions. While someone else shoves in an LMA and gives 8 breaths a minute, or 10. I haven't, off the top of my head, it's 8 to 10. And that's it. From there, shock if it's VF or VT, adrenaline and amiodarone, and that's it. So it's compressions are the most important thing. And this sounds a lot like what these new guidelines say. As far as a layperson CPR, our medical director, who's really fantastic, by the way, in case he's listening, he did a new piece where it's if someone's unconscious and they don't respond, push hard and fast in the center of the chest, or after you have someone call for an ambulance. And it was 30 to 2 no matter who, which is interesting because it's changing, man. When I first learned CPR in 1992, it was 5 to 1. I feel old.
I'm a little older than you. I started in 86. Well,
I was still in the stacked breaths, initial breaths era. So don't feel too old.
Oh
my gosh! Transport jockey just said he was 7 in 92. That ages me a little bit. Oh my gosh!
Can we take him off the chat?
Yeah, I'm gonna delete him right now. No, can I
delete him right from there?
I'm not sure that qualifies for the chat.
Peter says he's too young for this. Well, and Ben, I'm sorry, I was laughing because everybody in the chat was saying that we actually needed an interpretation of what you were saying, but I actually got it. And when I was in New Zealand last year, because last year I was in New Zealand, blah, 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 but they said I should go out and get pissed, and I really thought that they were just being mean, but then I really found out what that meant, which was pretty cool. But I think you guys do something pretty awesome, which is you stick an LMA in, and that's so easy, so fast, requires no skill, and it's taken the value out of the airway, which is what we really want. And even Jeff said that, you know, we need to maybe move that airway back, or maybe it's Jeff or Bill, I don't remember who, but one of the two said, move the airway further back. We don't really even need it. Let's just start doing compressions. And you guys have really done that. And do you guys know what your ROSC is?
Our ROSC is, well, if we use the Utstein model, it's about 8%. It varies a little bit here. We don't have a really good pad program. It's kind of spatchy and sporadic. Patchy and sporadic. There we go. But it's getting better. The New Zealand Fire Rescue is trying to come on board with first response to cardiac arrest in rural areas and in certain areas like metropolitan Wellington. They've been doing it for a few years. Metropolitan Wellington has this thing called Project Seattle, and I think their goal is to equal or beat the survival rate for Medic 1 King County, which is very ambiguous. But look, nobody ever died from cardiac arrest. No, that's not true. Nobody in cardiac arrest died.
Everybody dies of cardiac arrest. Nobody just making sure you understand that. Arrest.
That's right, mate. That's right. Nobody in cardiac arrest ever died and not having. Yeah, you see, there you go. You've been fooling us the whole time.
Nobody ever died.
Nobody in cardiac arrest.
And you've just named the show, just so you know.
Yes. No one in cardiac arrest, mate, ever died by not having an endotracheal tube shoved down their gob. If an LMA is in place and working well, which, let's face it, 99% of LMAs do work very well in cardiac arrest, we are actively discouraging it being replaced with an endotracheal tube. It adds to your scene time. It's difficult while you're fossicking around there with a laryngoscope going, nah, bloody hell. It's hard for people to do chest compressions while you've got an intensive care paramedic fossicking around this dude's mouth to intubate him. And it's just not necessary. So we are actively discouraging the practice of people intubating a cardiac arrest patient if a laryngeal mask is in place and is working well.
Good. You know, I think what we're going to have to do, though, is we're going to have to take – we've discussed this about ARIA before, but we're going to have to take and look at it and use it as a treatment tool. I've had situations where I've worked my cardiac arrest started out with BLS Airways, and we did great. And just recently, we had a cardiac arrest, VFib. We BLS'd the airway. Next thing we know, we lost our airway. There was just so much vomit, so much emesis. It was like turning on a frosty machine. It just kept going. Ooh. And, you know, it was horrible, and it was just – you know, a situation that we had a very difficult time getting. I mean, we got with a bougie. We ended up going to a king tube, which still wasn't effective because I've just never seen such a messy airway in years on us. And I think we have to look at it. And sit, as we get to that scene, look at it. How's my airway right now? Can I BLS it and go from there? Or do I need to grab the airway and go ahead and grab it? And that's the, you know, thing that we've done before. I've done that, and I kind of just see a cardiac arrest, and I look at the airway. It's full of emesis, and we drop a tube right away. So we got to kind of look at it, you know, we can't eliminate it completely, but we've got to use it as a treatment option based on what we're looking at.
Well, we can't eliminate it completely, but I think it's...
Whoa, too many people. Scott, go ahead.
I'm sorry. We can't eliminate it completely, but I think deprioritizing it is the right thing. I really think that intubation, especially moving away from King Airways, LMAs, and everything else, needs to be looked at as more of a life-sustaining skill than a life-saving skill. You know, it's exactly like Kyle said, is that, you know, you establish that airway to prevent against aspiration and to provide better oxygenation. But at the same time, if the BLS side is working well, why not stick with it?
Good point. Dr. Myers?
Yeah, I was going to say very similar. We shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater, but as our friend down under said, it does take longer than we anticipate to intubate somebody in cardiac arrest. It means you're not doing compressions while you're intubating. If you take a look at your ZOL or your physio code summary, you'll see that there's large gaps of time while the attempts are being made to intubate the patient. So really, we should go with LMA or King or Combi or SALT or whatever very simple, very fast airway if it's needed, and leave intubation for another patient.
Yeah, that's true.
Wow. Everybody's talking. I let the podcast go a second. Right. Everybody's talking. Sorry. Jeremiah, go ahead.
No, I was just saying it's like what we do with any other treatment. It's a step-up system. We want to start with the least invasive and then work our way up. Or if we come on scene and we see that this is a difficult airway and there's already vomit and, you know, we assess it as needed. There is no real gold standard, I believe, of this is the best airway, because everyone has their own unique anatomy. Everyone has their own unique arrest. And sometimes a basic airway is the best airway for that patient. And other times an ET tube is the best airway for that patient. And saying that a King airway is the end-all, be-all, and we need to get rid of intubation protocols is foolish. And saying that endotracheal tubes has been the best thing for 30 years and that's all we're ever going to have is foolish. We need as many tools and as many strategies as we can have to get an appropriate airway. And the second half of that would be still bringing ourselves back from that whole medic ego, which I see in young providers and I see in older providers that feel like a successful airway is an intubation, and an intubation is what makes me a medic. And for me, a successful resuscitation or a successful treatment is doing what's right. I want an airway. I don't really care how I get it. I just want an airway. And if we can, you know, get rid of that whole, like I said, ego mentality and just provide the best airway for that patient, I don't know, we can sort of get past that whole thing and just actually work on the situation at hand.
Okay, I'm going to just point out one thing. This is not an airway conversation. This is a CPR conversation.
No, it's not an airway conversation. It is.
That's what we always go there on the show. Always, 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 always.
It all goes back to education.
Right. That's true. That's very true.
Cricothyrotomy is for everyone.
Oh, Lord. Well, I've done one, and I never want to do it again.
Never mind. Never mind. Bill has never mind AT tubes. Let's just do compressions.
I'll just edit that out. I'll edit out. I'll edit out all the airway stuff. It's good.
Bill has to go to the bathroom.
How about the inner part?
Bill has to go to the bathroom.
Well, all right. So I'm going to give everybody one last shot on the CPR stuff, and then we're going to move on to paramedics driving into a lake. So speak now. Bill has a question. Apparently, he's holding up his hand, which he looks really cute doing that, doesn't he? Go ahead, Bill.
I think I had to go pee.
Well, I did want to bring it back into the real thing behind the guidelines that I think don't want anyone to lose sight of is that this increased effort for us to look at providing high-quality chest compressions, and that everything else other than defibrillation are unproven science, and there's a lack of information to support it. But there's clearly strong evidence or a growing body of evidence of the value of high-quality chest compressions. You know, they clearly say now that you would want to make sure that your rate is at 100 at least, that your depth is a full 2 inches now, that you are doing complete recoil on the chest, that you're minimizing your interruptions or trying not to have them at all. And I think that that's the emphasis is we've really – you know, I've been around it long enough to know that we got really tied up in doing all of our stuff that we thought was making a difference, and we failed to realize that it was really one of the most basic things. And Dr. Kudinchek, who's out of the Seattle area, he thinks that if we really focus, and he calls it he uses an inverted pyramid, and at the pinnacle he has CPR. And he says if we can really get that where it needs to be, then maybe all this other stuff that hasn't worked will work much better because we really are emphasizing the foundation. So I think that that's really one of the key messages in there is that I want to get my people doing CPR nearly for every minute of the time. I'd like them to be as close to 100 compressions out of every minute of the time. And until I can achieve that, I'm not really too much worried about the other stuff. That's the thing we need to focus on right now. That seems to make a huge difference. That and electricity.
Well, you know, it's something I just remembered, and I don't know if anybody else brought this up, but the guidelines also said at least 2 inches deep, not 1.5 to 2, because who's going to sit there and measure it? But it said at least 2 inches. And somebody, I think it was Peter, just brought up in the chat that, is that the same for everybody? And it is the same. It's the same for pediatrics. It's the same for infants. It says CAB. It says push hard, push fast, get it going. And the other thing is electricity. And that was never really recommended on infants before today. Chris, you had an interesting point about... Chris is gone. I maybe need to bring her back on. Carissa brought up an interesting point, if she's even still around. Sorry, I have to... This is the fun part about the podcast that you never get to see when we're actually doing it otherwise, unless I don't edit it out. Anyway, Carissa brought up a point that the Red Cross actually came on board really quickly because they had kind of drifted away from this idea of hands-only CPR where we had kind of gone. And Carissa said today that Red Cross came on board just like that as soon as they released the guidelines. So it sounds like everybody's coming on board with this, and probably Ashy and everybody else will start going there soon. Other thoughts or last thoughts?
My last thought is that a lot of my mates who are ambos have been complaining that you guys feel like taxi drivers. And hey, mate, with the change from ABC, now it's cab, it's just been affirmed. And I know that's bad for taking the piss, but see, it's true.
I think we just lost Ben. I don't know what he was saying there. It just kind of got all like down under-ish. British, don't understand. I don't know what he said, but something there. Are you still there, Ben?
He got very excited.
I think so. But apparently he said now we're more than taxi drivers, which I always thought we were. But just making sure. Oh, there he is.
I was taking the piss, so I'll just leave it there.
Well, thanks, Ben. Jeff or Scott, do you guys have anything else?
Yeah, I just want to say that I think it's really, really good for the layperson. I think that it's something that's going to encourage more people to do CPR, like we said. And I think a lot of the changes are long overdue for the pre-hospital provider, and it's going to make a difference.
Well, it's going to be easier, and that's what's good. I'm pretty happy about that. All right, so while we transition topics and go to paramedics driving into the lake, I just want to show you something. I got a little card right here. I'm going to show you the back of it because the front of it actually has the code. Boingo. Right there. I'm going to give you a free hour of Boingo along with that Audible. So if you had listened earlier, there's an Audible offer and there's a Boingo offer. Boingo.com gave us a free hour of Wi-Fi. They have over 100,000 different locations around the world. And if you give us a call, 303-720-6001, give us your idea for the show next week, you'll be entered to win. And it will be a random person drawn because it is a giveaway. It is not a contest. So right there, the lawyer says, I have to say, more than 100,000 spots worldwide, boingo.com. And we'd also like to thank audible.com for providing our sponsorship tonight. All right, so this week, if you guys were following some of the news, we actually got to see the unfortunate, tragic news of two paramedics from Victoria in British Columbia that crashed on their way home after a call. Now, Kyle and I were talking about this before the show, and all of the reports, said that the ambulance drove into a lake. Now, if you go to gems.com or you go anywhere else, go anywhere else and read it. Now, Kyle, you can take the punchline on this one.
Yeah, so I'm reading this, and all the, you know, EMS One and Gems and all the various sites were coming, EMS World, were all saying, paramedics drive, die after driving in the lake. And I'm like, wait a minute. I mean, you would think that they would realize that, or they're in trouble when their feet are getting wet from the floorboards, as it starts to get wet. But that's not really the issue. The problem is that they fell off a cliff into a lake.
It was
a windy road. And they went 60 meters straight down into a lake. So it's not that they just drove into a lake. They fell off a cliff, off the side of the road. If you look at the video, and I don't know, Chris, if you'll be able to post the link, but they actually have video of it, and it's like road wall down. So there was like almost no shoulder to this. It's a horrible, unfortunate accident that this occurred. But the way that all the sites are reporting it is they drove into a lake and they died. That's not really what happened. It's more like they fell into the lake and they're probably already critically injured before they hit the water by how far that they rolled down the ravine on that. So, I mean, we can get into all the specifics as to what was going on, but it was a pretty narrow road up in British Columbia, B.C., that, it is right on a curve there, and they just went over and into that. And it's unfortunately a terrible, horrible accident involved. And I have to give a thumbs down to the media for reporting it and titling it the way they did. I think that was really, in my commentary, disrespectful. for that?
Well, here's my question. Because they'd gone to a hospital, dropped off a patient, were coming home. Somebody had emailed me this topic actually early, like right the day it happened, and it was one of our listeners from Canada. And she said, this would be a good topic for your show. And she said, could this really play into the idea that it was, you know, doing 24-hour shifts is too long, or maybe they fell asleep at the wheel? I don't know. I mean, I wasn't there, and unfortunately there was nobody there that saw it. Were there skid marks? I don't remember hearing that in the report, but I'll actually post the
YouTube. There were, yes.
There were, okay. So that means they maybe overcorrected, maybe a deer, elk, something in the roadway caused them to crash. And unfortunately, we probably will never know, which is always a good reason maybe to have a camera in your ambulance. So that we can learn, unfortunately, from mistakes. But boy, I hesitate to say that it was because of fatigue or driver error. I think that can come into it sometimes. But I don't often hear that in our industry where ambulances are crashing because of 24-hour shifts or something like that. So I have to think that something else happened in this case. And boy, I have to say, first off, I my heart goes out to the family and the families that are left behind and the crews that are there, because it is hard when you lose somebody that you're affiliated with. And somebody that you've worked hard with and you've been on scene with, and whether it's from natural disease process or whether it's from an accident like this, and it's very tragic. So my heart goes out to you. That does not excuse the fact that the media are dorks in this case, where they said, oh, the ambulance drove into a lake. And you're right, because Kyle, that's immediately what I thought. I'm like, how did they die? It just drove into a lake. I mean, couldn't they have jumped out and been fine and swam or whatever? But when you see it, there's debris everywhere. It's pretty, very, very tragic. So, so this brings up the broader question as of how the media reports what we do and driver fatigue. I can go either way on the topic, but I wanted to hear what people thought.
You think there would was there any gain by the media to omit that fact that there was a cliff involved? I mean, because obviously some sources have that detail and some decided to report it authentically and others did not. Would there be any reason for those that did not, for the sake of their viewership or something else? There's my era of EMS conspiracy, but you know,
it comes down. Well, no, it's not so much that, but it's kind of like, look at the aspect. If you see, you know, a title says paramedics die when driving into lake, you're going to read that. You're like, what? What does it mean, died going into the lake? So it's going to make you read that article, as opposed to ambulance, you know, paramedics die after falling, you know, after driving off a cliff. That pretty much tells me everything about that article. I can skip on, you know, to that if I'm not interested. It's a curiosity thing as to why. Yeah, someone just said epigenetic junkie, good old term. If it bleeds, it leads. But this gets them, you know, it kind of grabs them and pulls them in. We don't have Chris on here in terms of the marketing anymore. But I mean, it's really in terms of media, is it's, you know, titling it to grab the viewer, to bring them in, you know, to that article.
Well, I think I agree. If it bleeds, it leads.
Well, okay. So, I guess then the bigger question is: do you guys think that this could have been because of driver fatigue? Have you ever? Here's the bigger question: have any of you ever been driving an ambulance any time of the day and kind of noticed yourself kind of doing one of these and nodding off?
Yes.
Yes.
And I'll say yes. No. This can be because of fatigue. Right. Go on, Scott.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, thankfully, no for me, but I also work in a system that highly discourages 24-hour shifts. And I am not a big fan of them myself. I think that here's a perfect reason why. I just pulled a little bit of information on this, and you're looking at a 2.5-hour drive from where they were to where they were going. So, yep. You know, so obviously this was some sort of long-distance transfer call. And I really kind of think that, especially in the private industry, when you're running those sorts of calls, and those calls are a possibility, that fatigue aspect needs to come into play when you're thinking about who you're taking and how you're structuring what you do. I have a tough time putting people in that situation on 24-hour shifts when they could spend, you know, the last 4 hours of that shift on the road, doing that long distance transfer, constantly driving, etc. I really have a hard time with that.
You know, the thing is, though, and I agree, the 24-hour shifts are really hard. But let's go beyond that. Let's go quite beyond that. How many EMS providers work two or three jobs? I mean, probably the average paramedic works at least, you know, or EMT works at least two jobs. And they may do, you know, an 8 or 12-hour shift at one place and go right from there right to the next job. So where does it come into, you know, in the companies? We can't just blame the companies for this. We have to, you know, look at ourselves. Yes, we can sit there and say, well, it's the pay. But we also have to look there and say ourselves and say, listen, you know, I can't go into work. I can't work the next day. You know, for us, I should not be scheduling back-to-back shifts. In flight medicine, they would actually tell us that we were not allowed to work within 8 hours of our oncoming shift. So we had to have 8 hours off. They would not let us do a part-time job doing that.
Yeah, somebody in the chat just said they work for three companies. Who's that? Paramedic 0750 works for three companies. That's a travesty. That's not, I understand you have to make a living for it, and I'm not saying anything about you. I'm saying that says something about our industry that we have to work through. How many nurses work three different jobs? How many physicians work three different jobs? Now, I'm not saying they're not fatigued, and I'm not saying they're not overworked, because they are. But we have a problem in our industry. We can't make a living.
I also want to know is how many of those folks that work multiple jobs work for private EMS as opposed to work for municipal services.
That's true. It's very true.
If I can just pop it up,
if you work for a municipal service, you're not doing those long distance transfers. You're not being fatigued in exactly the same way that a private provider is. And there have been a lot of municipal systems that have gone away from 24s for safety, and that's great. But they're not, I would say, they're not chronically subjected to the sleep deprivation that a private responder may experience on their normal shift.
You know, Jeremy, I got to disagree with you on that. You know, if you go for hour, I think some of these municipal systems are just as busy. You know, we'll run on my system an 8-hour shift. We'll run 15 calls on our one truck alone, and that's including transports with that. We don't do the inner facilities, but, you know, that's a lot faster, a lot moving. So, you know, I would tend to disagree with you a little bit on that. You know, I understand.
I'm not saying that a municipal system isn't busy. I mean, here we're one of the busiest systems in the country and the state. But in this particular case, saying that they were 2.5 hours away from their destination, and we're saying this is obviously a long-distance transfer, there is a difference, I think, between running back-to-back emergencies over the course of an hour and a half and sitting on a dark highway and driving down the road and staring at the dotted lines on the road for hours and hours, and that type of fatigue that brings to the provider.
Bill, go. You're holding your hand up. So patiently.
Okay. you know, I think that there's nothing I can't disagree with anything that's been said, but what we have is a lack of data. We don't have the information to answer this question, and while there's been some small studies that have been done and looked at this, we lack a real good accident investigation, injury investigation of our industry. So we really don't know. But I think everyone would agree with me that all you have to do is look at any of the online EMS sites and see the number of accidents, ambulance accidents, that are reported on almost a daily basis. And what we're not capturing is why. You know, is it truly a big issue? How many road miles are there really done? We lack data. And so we can sit here and we can have some strong opinions one way or the other, but without having the true information to know, it's very difficult, you know, and so we don't know. Look at what it's taken to get the helicopter industry to come under the degree of scrutiny that it recently has, but yet there's a lot more ground ambulances that are crashing on a national basis with fatalities. I would venture, just guessing, that may exceed what's happened in the helicopter industry. And why aren't
we? But the problem that we're having
there.
the problem that we have, Bill, is in terms of trying to do that data collection, is where does it fall under? When you have Firebase services, when they crash or they're injured, they're put in under the Firebase injuries and groups. Private services, some of them don't even record it. They go to workman's comp. It goes into like an other category. Brian McGuire from University of Maryland, Baltimore County, was working on a whole injury paper on EMS, and the one thing that they ran into was trying to get the data for this, because there really is no grouping, in NIOSHnet for EMTs and paramedics. They kind of fall under, various other categories.
Oh, I agree, and that's exactly where I'm drawing from, is that information there, is that we, as a group of people, EMTs and paramedics, regardless of who you work for, we don't have important information that's available about what's happening. What is our morbidity and mortality rate for this profession? We don't have a clear understanding of it. And like the fire service does a much better job of capturing this information than we do in our industry. So we're definitely at a disadvantage. So I don't want to discount anyone's beliefs, but it would just be so much stronger if we were doing it based upon facts versus our guts. Chris, now I can see what you do when we're online.
Dude, I'm moving, man. I'm moving, I'm shaking, I'm doing like 20 other things. And see, that's why video is bad, because you'll actually see all my bad habits. And I do agree that as an industry, we have a problem. I think we're probably the most underreported industry as far as injuries and deaths. Firefighters get it. Cops get it. Long-haul truckers get it, and we don't even get it. So we need to start moving for that in our industry, because I think that if we want to make this thing go, whatever it is, we need to make sure that we're doing it for the right reasons. And part of that is education. Part of it is getting the data. And part of it is making sure that that people actually believe in us and they trust us. And we're an industry that people can research and do things. So I completely agree with you, Bill. You're not going to get an argument out of me on that one.
I was ready for a fight if you were going to.
Sorry, I'm not going to do it. This is, unless somebody's going to play devil's advocate on this, I don't see why we wouldn't push for more ambulance regulation, more ambulance safety, which is my opinion.
And you brought up two good things, black box and the video.
We don't call them black box any longer. We call them driver safety monitor, because I think
driver safety monitor. Stop!
It is. Driver safety feedback.
It's a way to prevent yourselves from being sued. That way,
no, it's not. No. Nope. Wrong. Wrong.
Wrong.
Yep.
It is a quality assessment assurance progress.
Does it give feedback?
Chris, may I please?
Go, Scott. Go, Scott. Please save me. Save me.
I've had one of these systems in place in my service for the last 8 years. It serves multiple purposes. We do see a reduction in speeding, in intersection accidents, etc. We also have the data to back it up, like Kyle says. So it does serve that purpose, but there are other purposes that it serves. It has G-force readouts. And it gives you real-time feedback. I don't like the term real-time correction, because it's kind of it ends up being a Pavlov's dog kind of thing. But it's definitely gives real-time feedback, and you see a behavioral change in people, and you see just improvement. Driver operation improvement is definitely there with it.
True negative reinforcement.
Somebody just gave me a private tweet here, and they reminded me that we actually have a place to go where we can report incidents in EMS, and I can't think of it. It's like emsincidentsomething.com. I can't think of the name. I'll find it and I'll put it in the show notes. But really, it's a place where we can record incidents in EMS. Not only things that we do as errors, but things that come up. I know something that happened to one of my crews recently that we want to report is a problem with the King Airway. And if other people are having problems with it, we want to see that. But I think it's good for driver error too. And Kyle, I'm going to pick on you a minute, because you know what? Those black boxes that you call them, actually give driver feedback, and they actually teach people what the limits of the vehicle are. And I'm a Greek or I'm a geek? What am I?
Greek.
Look at my nose, dude. That is the profile of an Italian right there. No, I'm telling you right now, though. No, because we have a Greek on the podcast. That's Carissa. That's an Italian nose, bubby. No, I just have to say that it gives driver feedback because it gives the little ticking, and if you get too, and it ticks faster, the faster you go. And as long as that's enabled, I think that it helps the driver of the vehicle recognize when they're over-driving the vehicle, which is what this is really about, because people don't know the limits of the ambulance. They drive it like a, I think we even talked about this at EMS Expo. You get out of your little tiny Honda Civic, and you hop in a 15,000 GVW vehicle, how are you going to expect that thing to stop as fast as your 2,000-pound Honda Civic?
No, no, no. Here's the thing. Is it ticks. You said it ticks. It ticks at a certain speed?
Yeah.
Okay, what's the speed?
You can set it.
Okay, so what is the speed that is set for you guys?
It's set on the highway at 65 miles an hour, and if the lights are on, it sets at 70.
So 70. That's great on a sunny afternoon in July.
That's true.
What happens when it's December, you've got ice on the road, and it's slippery? I'm not getting my ticking. You know, I'm driving. I don't have a ticking. Tick. There's no tick, tick, tick. I must be driving safe enough. So that's the problem with that type of negative.
And I have an answer for that, because we actually send all of our people through ice driving school.
But it doesn't give you a tick.
You're just mad because I'm right, and you're just mad because you're trying to make a point, and I'm right.
No, because it's not. You're not right in that, because you know they send you to ice driving school. That's like sending me to EVOC school. You know, you're trying to argue that this black box that ticks makes a difference in their driving, and I'm going to say I disagree.
It does.
I say it's going to disagree because it doesn't change a factor that they don't take into consideration the road conditions, the time of day with that.
Can I ask you a question? You know, do you have them in your service?
Go ahead.
Do you have them in your service?
Pardon?
Do you have them in your service?
We do not have them in our service.
Scott, do you have them in your service?
Absolutely, and that's the other thing I was going to say, if I could, just real quick, is I've been in the same ambulances in the last year with the boxes and without the boxes, and the difference that I see driving Priority 1, Code 3, whatever you want to call it, is dramatic.
Yep. Ben, do you guys have those in New Zealand?
We don't, mate, but if I find a black box that ticks in my ambulance, I'm calling the bomb squad. I'll just be a bastard for a minute and play things into it. In any 24-hour period, our ambulance officers are only allowed to work 13 hours. They're only allowed to work 5.5 hours continuously. They must have a 30-minute break. There are some exemptions for the rural guys, who are the only resource out there in the WOPS. And if you go over your driving hours, you get stood down, and they bring someone else in for cover. So... I know you guys are hating me right now, but if you guys are having all these ambulance crashes and, you know, I follow the online forums a bit, and we were having a recent discussion as to what foods are acceptable, so that the driving officer is able to eat them while he's driving to cut down on... to ensure that he gets an adequate meal during his 12-hour shift, because we don't have rest breaks. So, hey,
French fries.
Am I able to
eat? Yeah, it's like
French fries. Because I always find that old McDonald's French fry underneath the seat in the driver's side of the ambulance. Yeah. Don't you guys find, and it's like petrified. Yeah, I'm like, what the heck do they make this thing out of? It's like, you could hurt a person with that thing. We're getting a little outside the topic, but hybrid medic asks, so would a camera be more effective than a black box?
That I would say to a point.
Hold on a second. Here's the thing. What is the camera going to do real time when the incident happens?
Wow.
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. That more so than having a road safety feedback system in your truck. I mean, I know we're getting off topic a little bit, but the camera's going to tell you what happened after the fact, but
yep,
I don't know what,
absolutely,
what difference it's going to make real time for the person behind the wheel.
Absolutely. Thank you. Point made. Discussion over.
I don't think any of it works. Yeah. Anyway. But, you know, here's one thing. Let me close it. We actually had this whole discussion on First Few Moments on the last. Jeez, Chris, we took another topic from First Few Moments.
Oh, you're pissed because I actually, I didn't even bring this up.
Anyways, all seriousness, though.
I know.
The one thing that we talked about, and I think that we have to look at the air medical industry. We always hammer the air medical industry about their crashes and their safety record. But the one thing that they do that I think we need to start to look at is have what's known as a sterile cockpit. When we're in front of that ambulance driving, the AM/FM radio is off. You know, the mobile data terminal is maybe turned away from the driver on that. All conversation is strictly on the task at hand. If there's two people up front riding, both sets of eyes are outside the vehicle scanning the area for dangers and hazards. Communication should be just limited to that. And that's what I think we should start looking at in terms of the EMS industry and the ambulance industry, is taking that whole idea of sterile cockpit and applying it to how we operate our own vehicles and not eating French fries on the way.
Good point.
Right.
Especially with the ketchup that's everywhere. And sorry. All right, so yeah. I'm closing the topic unless the two doctors have something to say. Good enough. We're just happy to get patients. That's what they're saying. Well, Bill doesn't care because he's not a doctor. He continually reminds me of that. He's a PhD.
Aren't we getting towards the end of our time?
We are. We're actually right there. And I just want to remind everybody, Boingo and audible.com. Remember, if you call our phone number, if you forgot it, rewind the show, hear our phone number, send us your topic idea for next week. If it doesn't matter if we use it or not, we're actually going to put your hat in the drawing and I'll pull it out right there live on the show. Don't forget to leave your email address and your name and phone number. You can't enter. The people on the podcast can't enter. Sorry.
I don't have a hat. I don't want to give you my hat. I like my hat.
Your gifts are on the way. All right. So we're wrapping this puppy up. Thank you guys very much for joining us this week. Thank you. So let me ask the audience a question in the live chat. Did you like the way this is going? Do you like the whole video thing? Hey, Jamie, can you put Kyle and I up with the audience question real quick? Because that was pretty cool. Can you do that? Ah, perfect, because I want to look down at them. That's awesome. And they can look up. Hi.
Kind of reminds me of the Brady Bunch.
It does, kind of, a little bit. Hi, Bill. Anyway, sorry. It just reminded me of it earlier. So, Carissa, please wrap us out of this thing. Tell us, you're back now, and tell us about the what you wanted to plug right toward the end of the cardiac discussion. We've bored her to death. All right, we'll come back to her. Ben Hoffman, where can people find you? You don't want to be found? You're not on Twitter? What's up?
I am on Twitter, dude. I just can't remember my thingy. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. I'll find my thing. I'm Round Man. I'm at an EMS forum near you, but you just haven't figured out who I am yet.
But you said your name is Bill Hoffman. Ben Hoffman. Sorry. All right, fine. We'll find you, Ben. I'm sure we can find you. I'm sure we'll find you. I have people. Have you not heard? I'm Italian. We'll find you. Jonah Bush, where can people find you?
You can find me on the Twitter webs and Facebook and on the blog, all under the same name, Geramedic, which is Jeramedic. And also the Gen Med show. Check that out with Miss Natalie Clubita, who's working tonight, but she Skyped me a few minutes ago and says hi to all of you and wishes she could be on. But
we love
that's
Natalie.
Where you can find me.
Right on. Thank you, sir. Dr. Jeff Myers, where can people find you?
I'm on Facebook as well, and my website is photoemsdoc.com.
Photoemsdoc.com. Thank you, sir. Scott Keir, where can people find you?
I can be found on Twitter at MedicSBK and on my blog, EMS in the New Decade, at 2010emsblogspot.com.
Ooh, that's what that means. That's very cool.
I know.
Carissa, are you back yet, or are you listening? Have you bored you to death? Apparently so. Okay, good enough. Well, let me pull up what Carissa wanted me to say, or what she was going to say anyway. Carissa was going to plug the Sudden Cardiac Arrest Foundation Push Hard and Fast t-shirts available at sca-aware.org/shop. That's the Sudden Cardiac Arrest Foundation Aware. So it's sca-aware.org/shop. And you can get your Push Hard, Push Fast t-shirt there. Or Push Hard and Fast. I don't know. Sounds really good either way, because it sounds like fun. Gosh, this podcast has really gone downhill. So Kyle David Bates and Dr. Toon, since I have you both on the video and I can see you, where can people find you? Go ahead, Kyle.
Image Medic on Twitter. You can find me over at KyleDavidBates.com. Check out our websites at firstfewmoments.com, as well as our new one, PDUPEDI-U.com, as well as for a podcast for the pediatric emergencies. Thanks, Chris, for having me.
Very cool. Thank you, and thanks for disagreeing with me. I love it. Dr. Toon, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at WFToon. You also can find me on Facebook for the EMS Educast. We're there on the Facebook. And I'm also participating in a new podcast on EMS research. So you'll be seeing that joining the EMS radio network, I believe. And you'll hear more of that group talking just specifically about EMS related research.
I know, and I think Harry the Mac Medic is going to kill me. I keep trying to talk to him, and it's been a nightmare of a week. So, Mac Medic, I'm off all day tomorrow. Call me. You have my number. Call me.
You have a day off?
I take Fridays off generally, but they never turn into a day off. So, dude, you got to call me early, 8 a.m. my time, because that'll work. So, Harry, give me a call tomorrow. We are premiering the EMS Research Podcast in a couple weeks. We will also be premiering a couple new shows. And here's a new show coming up that's kind of cool. And I'll give you a hint. It's called EMS Geek. I'm not going to tell you any more than that. And it's awesome. It's going to be a funny show. All video, 5 to 10 minutes, and you're going to love it. Thank you for doing all of our video editing, Mr. Jamie Davis. Thank you. Are you going to give a wave and a shout out on the video here? Come on, say hi. Say hi to everybody here, Jamie. I know you're there. Yay! Thanks, Jamie. We appreciate it. Oh, what was that? Somebody breathing heavy in the mic. Well, I'm Chris Montero, Geeky Medic, and I'd like to thank you all for joining us tonight and joining all the mayhem. If you want to stick around after, we're going to stay in chat, at least I am, for a few more minutes, and stay on the internet, hear the intertubes, and talk to people, because I really enjoy that and have a lot of fun. Join us next time when we talk more about issues that concern you in EMS. Have a great night or a great day.